Hello and welcome to the February 22nd edition of The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio. The solution to Los Angeles' micro-broadcasting equation.
Yeah, that's a tough kind of calculus, if you ask me.
I'm Steve Cato, and I am here with none other than the unbelievable Nicholas Miller.
Thanks, Steve. I always wonder what that look I got was from people. I guess it's disbelief, isn't it?
Yeah, tell me about it. You don't know whether you're coming or going in days like this. Ain't it the truth?
Yeah. Mostly going, I think, mostly.
Right.
I mean, not enough coming.
Yeah, it's good that you say that. I'm also looking forward to doing some of our rare commissioned work. We had quite a fair bit of it early on, and it's just been hard to arrange these days. So what a thrill to know that we have so much to look forward to. I know for a fact that our friend, Chuck JPC, that's right, the train guy, I know that he's got, itching to do some talking for us soon. So, that's one thing that our listeners can, look forward to in the near future.
Yeah. Bring old Chuck back.
Yeah.
Never can get enough of those trains.
Anyway, it's the eve of the Art Book Fair, and so you know what that means.
Busy, busy, busy.
Yeah, exactly. There's an awful lot of people in town. There's an awful lot going on. It's a busy time.
Oh, yeah.
To be in Los Angeles. And
yeehaw.
Just a demonstration of that. We've got a very full house today. The studio is ram-jammed with people. Quite a crew.
Brimming, I would say.
I was assured that this wouldn't be the case, but it seems like someone has snuck in a musical instrument or two.
Ooh.
Well,
you know what we do with them.
We'll see how that goes down. I know that after the last music incident, we, Nicholas, laid down the law about talking. So, let's hope nothing unfortunate happens here tonight, people. But we have a great collaboration present here between a writer and a talker. We have the writing of Melody Summer Carnahan and the talking of Barbara Golden, all the way from Northern California. So, let's let them have at it, and, you know, I bet they thought they'd escape the rains by coming down here, but, you know, rain everywhere, the entire Western Seaboard. All right, folks, welcome to Los Angeles, and go for it.
On the plane of mind, a thought is a thing, and a mood is a place. Once upon a time, there was a woman named Barbara who lived at the corner of Alive and Jesus.
I am Barbara.
I am Barbara.
Barbara is me.
Barbara is me.
The corner of Alive and Jesus is the place where two streets meet. Though the streets themselves have nearly disappeared, the corner remains, and it is there she built her house. I built the house myself. Her house is four-sided with a peaked roof. The north wall is brick, with a thick fireplace and chimney. The south wall is made of redwood logs, stripped of bark and stained with oil. The east wall contains a solid wood door carved from a single tree, and through this door she goes in and out. The wall facing west, my favorite wall.
North wall, south wall, east wall, west wall, my favorite wall.
Forms a window paned with glass from which she can see out across a valley of purple and green to the top of Blue Mountain, way, way off over there, where the sun sets each night. Each morning, she stands in the doorway to watch the sun come up above a flat yellow strip of horizon. Evenings, she sits in her chair at the table with four square legs, and she drinks a pungent liquid made from the juice of pomegranate seeds. These pomegranates grow on a tree in her yard. They store up the summer sun, then burst open each autumn, spilling out jewel-like seeds that she collects and mashes in a sieve and strains through cloth and mixes with water in which highly refined sugar has been dissolved. She pours it all into an earthenware jar which sits fermenting right over there on top of the refrigerator. And all year round, she drinks this toast to the setting sun. I like the sunsets in winter best, because they last longer. But the ones in summer are more spectacular, especially if we've just had a thunderstorm. The other day I was watching the sunset, and there was this mammoth cloud. It was shaped like a submarine. There were no curvy lines, just straight black edges. It wasn't fluffy like a normal cloud. So, what are the other objects in her house? Well, as the story opens, we don't see much. The table, the chair, as I said before. I believe I mentioned the refrigerator. Yes, she does have electricity. A television set sits on top of a piece of brocade cloth on the blonde dresser in which she stores her neatly folded clothes. Over the face of the television set right now, she's draped a kind of net scrim. You see, the picture's on the blink, so she just uses the light as a flickering device. Actually, I've decided that I like TV better this way. I invent the images. Before the picture went bad, all the people were stretched out like figures in an El Greco painting. Now I just listen to the music and the voices and make up faces to go along. The curtain's a piece I cut from an old peignoir that my first husband's mother gave me as a bridal gift. Okay, what else? Well, not much. Barbara doesn't like to have things piling up around her. She lives a simple life. She takes her pleasures neat. One thing, though, I might mention is the ram's horn shofar given to her by her great-great-grandfather when she was a little girl. It hangs from a nail above the fireplace. She never takes it down to blow it. She doesn't even remember what it's to be used for, so she doesn't really see it anymore. She's not aware that it is cracked. Over there in the corner, a bed of exotic proportions takes up a lot of room in this one-room house. She's piled it high with satin pillows and goose-down quilts. She doesn't often spend her nights alone, but when she does, she's still quite comfortable. think you can tell a lot about a person by looking at their bed, don't you? Now, what's this story going to be about? Love, longing, metaphysical contentment? What? Don't worry, I'm coming to that. First, I must be sure to carefully set the scene. And I want you to hear a little more from Barbara. Barbara, are you there? How are you? Are you happy? Well, yes, I am happy. As long as things remain the same as they are right this minute, I'm happy. But of course, if things stay the same too long, I get restless. I want more.
I get restless. I want more. I get restless. I want more. I get restless.
All right, let's go down with the story then. Barbara has taken to collecting china lately. This is something entirely new for her, never really having taken notice of plates and platters and utensils before. We see her now coming in through the door with a load of cups and saucers. Some are Japanese, with gold diamonds at the rim. Some are from England, decked with fleur-de-lis and pictures of the queen. These here are American. Bundles of fruit and flowers and shades of red and gold and green on them. She stacks them neatly on top of the dresser around the TV. She flicks a switch and light pours out, warming her features. She licks her lips. She breathes. She moves towards the fire in the fireplace, which is always alight. She has a talent for keeping a fire alive. It's fall again and nearing Halloween. She hasn't had time to make anything for the children who will be visiting soon with their dogs on leash, expecting treats. She spent her days searching for dishes. It's nearly an obsession now, though Barbara would never use that word. She sits down in her chair with a small glass of the ruby liqueur and she sighs. If I were in his arms. A dull ochre cloud ignited becomes crimson and violet. Inside this time, she begins to calculate the number of men she's had as lovers. Where are they now? And why am I alone? I wonder how many of them are no longer alive. Just then, a large velvety purple moth flies across her window just in front of her eyes. She jumps up, shoots a bare arm out the window, and catches it as it flies by a second time. It's there inside her hand. She places it on the edge of her glass where it stays closed up as if in fright. She caresses it with her finger and moves the glass closer to the fire. But then, in a moment, she's left it because something larger has attracted her sight. What the hell was that? Outside, moving past the window, she thinks it must be a heron or a deer. But no, it's a monkey. This is very strange. A monkey here? The monkey's red. It's red all over, even inside its mouth, except for the tiny yellow teeth, which she now sees in a very long tail tipped a darker hue. Out goes her hand, and in comes the monkey, snickering and fidgeting in her hot palm. The monkey loses its grin and scrambles off to the corner of the room, down into the dark space under her bed. She sees it trembling there. "Oh, you must be cold," she says, down on her hands and knees, reaching for it. Suddenly, the monkey's up on her shoulder and crawling across her back, and now clings tenaciously to her knee. She plucks it off and sets it down by the moth, just a foot or so from the flame, where, apparently transfixed by the fire, the monkey and the moth remain. Barbara sits. She observes these creatures who have entered her life. The moth opens its wings, and Barbara sees a complex pattern of black, blue, and iridescent green radiating out from the center of the moth's furry body. The monkey, too, stares at the moth, and Barbara begins to see something impossible. A human being no bigger than a capital E is moving across the moth's back. Barbara is reminded. Yesterday, I went to the beauty supply store for some age control cream. And the male cashier asked me to help him identify one of the tiny images stamped from gold that they sell to be applied to fingernails. I held the little thing up to the light. Is it a bird of some kind or a flower? I suggested out loud. But what I thought I saw, though I didn't have any idea what it could mean, was a tiny woman with a hood or veil. And in one hand she carried a little pine tree, and with the other grasped a bag of pearls. Barbara now sees the same creature moving across the back of the exquisite moth. It's the very same tiny woman, draped in a white cape. Yes, she's carrying a tiny pine tree, and in her bag there must be infinitely small pearls. Barbara is moved by this sight. Is she real? Can she see me or sense my presence? As soon as this thought forms in Barbara's mind, the tiny woman disappears, snapped shut inside the moth's closed wings. The monkey has jumped to the ground and scratched open the door. And as it runs outside, the moth flies like light, straight out. That night, Barbara dreams. I am at a circus coming up through the floor in the center of the ring. Two choices are presented to me, two ways to get to my seat, which is high on a platform above me. The most direct but most difficult route is a knotted rope that I might climb hand over hand using all my strength. The other route is easier, a spiral staircase. I'm on my way up it when I notice the show has started. Four animals are circling in the ring. A jackrabbit, a squirrel, a wild dog, and a fox. Though two are predators, there's no sign of danger. But then, without warning, the fox goes for the squirrel and bites its tail end full up to the intestines. Blood spurts out the squirrel's mouth. La, 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 la. In the morning, Barbara leaves the house just before dawn. The sky lightens at her back as she rides her bike all the way to Hellendale. This is the first time in a long time that she has not watched the sunrise. She speeds past the armless and legless man, Mr. Fratterdeus, without her usual good morning, and without pausing to toss some coins into his hat. As she passes, his glorious voice surrounds her for a moment, like a halo. His body is barely more than the torso. From whence that incredible sound? His hymn this morning offers a richness and vigor she cannot admit in her haste. Entering Fratelli's cafe and restaurant, she encounters what she had hoped to find. A truck driver, done driving for the night, weary, worn, and reeking of engine oil. He sits alone at the counter in front of the automatic brewmaster, staring at a stuffed big-mouthed bass next to a plaster Buddha with a staff.
Hello, Jim.
She invites him back to her house. His name is Jim. She makes love to Jim then, and he tells her anecdotes about his life in the fast lane, as he calls it, before he falls asleep. She knows she isn't loving the lovemaking with him, and she knows she doesn't love him in any of the ways she's learned to love someone. She is simply afraid, and she's using his body as a shield. When he leaves later that day, she goes out to the south side of the house to a spot of dirt that contains traces of lithium, and she eats some of that dirt to ward off a killing form of lethargy she remembers from a few years back. That night, as the sky turns vermilion, she recalls the Chippewa belief that souls go toward the west after death. She thinks she might like to die soon because she is not getting what she wants. She thinks about her lover of the morning.
Choo-choo ain't just some train sound. It's the sound that he makes when my baby's in town with his mojo working.
He had explained to her that those big orange containers she sees stacked up at waterfronts first go on transport ships to ports, where they're placed on flatbed train cars and moved on rails across the country and attached to truck cabs and driven up over hills and down into cities to be delivered at precise locations by people like himself, the truckers of the world. She desires a more fluid theosophy like his. She would like to be the white dust she saw clinging to the tires of his truck as he pulled away from her. There were scars around his eyes from a time when he fell asleep at the wheel.
In the middle of the night, there is a sound. Just a light tapping, tapping, and it is, she sees, the moth flying against the glass. Barbara's mind begins to spin. Perhaps she will get the tiny woman to speak. Perhaps the tiny woman will open her bag and give Barbara some of those infinitely small pearls. Excitement turns to fear, turns to terror. Barbara knows this woman cannot be real, nor the monkey, nor the velvet moth. And if they are real, they must be from somewhere else. But where? She thinks maybe she's not had enough curiosity about the world. The moth lands in Barbara's hand and opens its wings. Nothing. No tiny woman there. Nothing but the intricate design that Barbara sees suddenly as possibly quite evil. At this thought, her house is filled with living things. Creatures of every kind. Birds, bats, reptiles of every size and description. Flying insects, huge fuzzy tarantulas. Sidewinders in pairs snaking across the floor. Owls, white and black, hooting. A family of tigers panting and pacing in the corner. An ocelot with moon-colored eyes. Three bighorn sheep. Two rams taking turns preparing to rut the ewe. Black birds screech and tear into each other. A red fox slides in the door, followed by five bear cubs rolling like bowling balls. Large black ants form a mount in the center of the floor. Two moose lock antlers and crash into the dresser, shattering the porcelain. All is mass, movement, sound. There is no room for thought. There is no air. Fire singes a gray squirrel's tail, adding another rank smell to the room. Two jackasses raid the cupboard. Hundreds of thumb-sized bees swarm, and a pack of wolves crowd the window, calling the night. A butter lamp she keeps lit on her bedstead is tipped by a weasel chasing a mouse, and 44 loons emerge from the fireplace, scattering embers. Soon the whole place will catch fire. What will she do? She's no longer master of her realm. Her bedclothes have been shat and peed on by the now copulating bighorn sheep. Flame scours the floor. Scorpions crawl through her dresser drawers. A goat eats the scrim from her television screen, and for a moment she sees a real face there. It is hers, reflected, mouth wide in a scream.
Everything in Barbara's house did catch fire, and everything burned, and while it burned, it remained the same, in the same form of burning still. Inside it changed, and she too burned. Barbara was herself on fire. She looked down at her hands, and there were flames moving across her body, igniting it, inspiring more flames to issue from each pore, and bigger jets of flame were shooting out from all the gates to her body. Barbara catches sight of herself in the television set, also in flames, even as it conveys a moving image generated somewhere very far away. The image is of a young woman, pale and sorrowful. This young woman stands at the edge of the deck of a ship, looking down into black water. Tears pool in her eyes and spill, hitting the railing and rolling off, dropping into the deep water. Tears form over and over. Each glistens for an instant, bright with moonlight, before traveling the length of the soft down of her cheek and off into the water. Behind her in a room aglow from electric chandeliers, an orchestra plays one of her favorite songs, while the man she considers the one true love of her life dances on and on in an intimate way with a great dark beauty. And this Barbara sees in her television mirror. It's an old movie. The picture exact for just this moment, it too ringed with flame. Bright blue fans of flame leap out, torch-like at each corner of the screen, forming a gloss or devotional rim to frame the moving picture of disillusionment, loss. And on the surface again, she sees her own face, bright with flame, flame shooting out her ears, mouth, and nostrils. Barbara could not bear this image of herself. She broke out the window by throwing her chair through it. Then she climbed up and jumped. It being impossible to exit by the door, with the ocelot tearing open the neck of a black rabbit. The night air rushed into her house with the impulse of the west wind. The flames were erased, and the fire no longer raged as it had before, fueled by her identity. From this point, we must go quickly on, for things are accelerating. Barbara's bare feet touch the soil. Her heart paces strongly as her skin cools and moisture collects on her upper lip. But no, something is happening here too, she says aloud. And for a brief moment, she is allowed to take in one complete breath of the rich, wet night air that rises like a vapor from the dirt and the leaves. It has a fingerprint, this night's air. She is certain that if she dies now, she will come back to it. To this scent, at least once before the parts of her being are dispersed. Then she looks around. She sees that from this very spot, clear out to Blue Mountain, Everything is growing at tremendous speed, bursting up with augmented vigor and strength. Pine, fir, spruce, and redwood trees bellow in their ascent to the heights and explode into blossom, berry, cone, and fruit. Seeds cascade to earth like hailstones. Leaves curl into color and are stripped from maple, birch, and aspen, are banished to earth with twigs, boughs, branches. Whole trees crash down in sweeps and pile up haphazardly, while grasses speed in lavish turns from early lavender to the deep plush of summer green and become straw, and then to dust they crust the earth along with petals crushed and berries withered and acorns split, brittle and spent. Vines spiral into the ground, pulling up their own roots. Tubers burst with nematodes, which is broom saps, xylem, and phloem. Kernels, apples, lemons, grapes, and pears turn blue with mold and drop, dropping, fall far into the earth, while above and around, points of light blur with the starry sky's lurid swirl of velocity. So what is going on here? Might we ask Barbara what she thinks of all this?
Barbara? Barbara?
I'm here, but I don't know what to do.
Barbara, you must have some thought. What are your ideas? What are your feelings?
I feel that I've been remiss all my life. I've been closed and impure and lazy, perhaps. I feel that there's something I must do, but I don't know what it is. I don't know how to stop all this. I don't know what it is.
Perhaps there isn't anything you can do. No. Perhaps you must just observe, see what happens.
Barbara does just that. Out of sympathy or exhaustion, she lies down on the soft dirt outside her house, now emptied of flames and animals. She is surrounded once again by trees shedding leaves and bark peeling off in a reasonable time pattern. She lies flat against the earth for such a long time, she is finally completely covered with leaves, and she sleeps. During that sleep, her heart stops once. Her connection with everything and everyone she treasures on this earth is severed, just briefly. And when her heart starts beating again, she is aware that she has entered a dream.
I stand in a wide field scattered with broken marble columns. One column has tipped and spreads out like poker chips. The sky is the blue of the veins in a baby's ear, or the color of a pre-Columbian rain goddess, or the underside of ribgrass. The horizon stretches out flat in every direction. A few friends are with me, sporting about on the marble. My first husband is off at a distance with my son. I watch them dig in the ground. My son holds a metal detection device. A violin falls toward me at tremendous speed from way up high in the air. As it nears, I see it's really a hair ornament, then a clothespin. Then again, it becomes a violin, just before taking the shape of a prism as it enters the earth. Pink clouds pass by, veined and faceted like chunks of rose quartz. A flying creature with a beetle in its claws buzzes my head. Another flying creature, this one transparent, stops and teaches us to fly, my friends and I. We are all quite suddenly aloft. Of course, how easy. How could we have forgotten this? we are just as suddenly back on the ground, and something like exhilaration fills our veins. We are made aware that we managed to avoid a dangerous white atomized substance encountered up there. Between two blue columns bearing orange flame stands a small brown-skinned man selling ceramic pins. One pin is in the shape of the tiny hooded lady. I see now, too, the red monkey on a leash. The monkey places a peanut between its teeth. The pins are lovely, I shout. I will buy one for every one. I want them all. The man informs me that I must work for him at the kilns, firing these little clay objects for the rest of my life. I agree to do so.
So that's Barbara's dream. A dream about a redemption born of diligence, not sacrifice. Perhaps it represents a generous attempt to make of her individual life a kind of large public conveyance. The kind of pleasure that might bring to herself and others. Barbara wakes and lifts herself from the ground. Amber, chartreuse, and magenta leaves are sticking to her nightgown. In some of the leaves, perfect droplets of clear water appear, for the night has pressed a fine net of mist upon the earth. She brushes herself off and goes back inside to put her house in order. There's one thing I neglected to mention, because it's difficult to describe. Well, here goes. As she lay in the dirt covered with fallen leaves, a small tickling thing came sniffing at her feet, and by crawling in under the toenail of her big toe, entered into her body. This tickling thing might be described as pure essence of being. A tiny thing, not visible to the eye, but detectable by feel when one is fully awake. Okay, so this little thing moved on its way up her leg inside a main artery, against the flow of blood, and moved right up through the uterus to her egg sac or ovary, and there it formed itself into a six-pointed star as it wrapped tight itself against that organ and made the organ hum like an engine that's just been lubed. Then the thing crawled on its six points right up to her chest in the area of the heart, where it again wrapped tight itself around that organ and squeezed just a little too much, which is why her heart stopped. But the heart started again with being loosed, and the star went along up to her brain, that bulging, protein-glutted organ with millions of eyes and blind alleys. There, the star spread out as waves that surged and opened up six new rooms in the mind to be later explored and inhabited by Barbara. And then, the star burst out through the top of her head at precisely the moment she made a sound ending the dream and returning her to the verity and variety of this world.
Wow.
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 What did you think of that, Nicholas?
It was lovely. You know, I mean, normally I'd be pretty harsh on all the instruments, but it seemed civil, you know?
Yeah, I also found the delivery interesting, especially the bit with the squirrel getting bitten in half and the guts and everything, but being delivered sort of like children's television, kind of.
Yeah, you know, but for children that it can accept violence and the distorted world that we live in, I like that little bit about the person no bigger than the letter E. E.
Yeah. Yeah, really odd flavor of talking, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'd be like going to Scoops in Chinatown, but ordering a really violent flavor, you know, like, oh, I'll have two scoops of Post Studio, or, you know, like Kicked in the Shin.
Certainly this is in the San Francisco style, let's say. Or one of the key San Francisco styles. That's right. There's also the Terry Riley School of San Francisco music. Of course. But definitely the San Francisco talking school.
Yeah. What do you think it is? You think it's all the hills?
Right. Well, I suppose it's true. That's true. We could have Jello Biafra on next time. We have had Jerry Brown on as well. So with that, I think we've got a busy day tomorrow. K-Chung Radio.
Oh, yeah.
All over the Los Angeles Art Book Fair tomorrow.
Splattered.
Nicholas and I aren't doing any projects at the book fair with the talking show, but we are, you know, gonna do a lot of behind the scenes work at K-Chung, get things moving, get things grooving, get on it. Yeah.
Ooh, ooh.
Yeah. Help out Gunther. Yeah. So we should have an early night tonight, I think. Good night, everyone. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good morning.
Namaste.